Good afternoon, everyone. How are we all doing? Yay! Hope everybody's having a great conference. No? I think it's been spectacular myself. My name is Jason Abel. I'm with Two Brothers Brewing Company. I'm also on the committee that helps put this on, which is why I said the conference is awesome. And as part of that, it's my distinct pleasure to be able to introduce. We have Mike Kallenberger and Lindsay Kunkel. They are brand strategy consultants, and they're going to tell us how to build a craft beer drinker. Guys?
Thank you.
Oh, silence your cell phones too, please. Forgot that one.
How do I get to the presentation itself? I'll just mention that I'm going to do a fairly short intro here. Then Lindsay will take over for her half, and I'll come back at the end and do my half of the presentation.
There you go.
Okay, thank you. And we do have a lot of material today, so we're going to go at a pretty good clip. I hope we don't go too fast, but I'm going to ask you to hold questions until the end. We should have time at the end, but as I said, there's a lot to go through here. So today we're going to explore basically the overall direction of American culture today, which has its important context for craft beer and what's going on in this business, clearly. The intersection of youth, gender, ethnicity, and beer. And then the attitudes, values, and motivations that separate craft beer drinkers from other people in the adult population. Lindsay actually works for the Futures Company. One of their main products is what's called the Enkelovich Monitor, if you haven't heard of that. It's an annual survey of Americans' attitudes and values. I consider it the foremost such survey in America today. I've been working with it people on this, Lindsay and her company, for close to 20 years now. I would tell you that back in the 90s, they were among the first people to identify the cultural shift that started to occur back then, that ultimately, I think, enabled craft beer to grow and prosper again. So they were the early warning on that. It does survey the attitudes and values and priorities, as I said, of American consumers. It's nationally and ethnically representative, and there's close to 10,000 adults that they survey every year. So first of all, just based on the Yankelovich Monitor data, who are the drinkers in 2016? Most of this is fairly familiar stuff, so I'll go through it quickly. We still see millennials continuing to account for a majority of the drinkers. You can see that millennials are 29% of the adult population, 41% of weekly beer drinkers in general, and 57% of weekly craft drinkers. We also still see the fairly heavy skew to higher incomes, with 66% of weekly craft beer drinkers earning $75,000 a year or more. No surprise, women continue to be seriously underrepresented. We'll address this in the second half of the talk today, accounting for about 25% of weekly craft beer drinkers. That number has been fairly stable for a few years. There is good news on Hispanics. I know there's a lot of interest in marketing and selling craft beer to Hispanics these days. I think that's largely because the Hispanic population is growing so fast. And traditionally, craft beer has been underdeveloped among Hispanics. But in fact, in this data, we're seeing that Hispanics represent about 20% of all weekly beer drinkers and 21% of weekly craft drinkers. So it seems like they're catching up to the rest of the population on that front. So without further ado, I'll let Lindsay cover the consumer context.
Thanks, Mike. Hello, everyone. Mike just introduced us to the overall drinkers that we're seeing, but we want to start by giving you a bit of a baseline understanding of who your overall market is. And we're going to do that by giving you three key themes that we're seeing in both your drinkers as well as those who could be your drinkers, so the entire 21-plus population. Those are a slowly steadying financial outlook, the blending of personal identity, and the values-driven consumption. So I want to start by talking about a bit of the consumer mindset around finances. Now, this is an area where a lot of industries had to be hyper-focused on in the past few years. Craft beer, maybe not so much, but it's an important area to keep your eye on. Now, you don't need me up here standing here telling you that the last few years have been a pretty rough ride from a financial perspective for a lot of Americans. But right now, we're seeing people on a macro level on a bit more solid ground. First, the job market is continuing to build. We see unemployment staying pretty consistently around that 5% marker. We saw about 3 million jobs come into the market in 2014 and another 2 million in 2015. So good news there. We also see lots of signs of life on the wage front. Wages are rising, and they're rising especially for lower-income consumers, which is highly important when you kind of want to stir up the marketplace. Walmart, in particular, the nation's largest employer, has promised raises in salaries for their hourly workers, as well as IKEA, Target, Starbucks, and many others. And last, we have seen cheaper oil prices. So with that comes more money in consumers' pockets, either to spend or to save. And on a more personal level, we're seeing some of the tensions that were there and lasting even after the recession had ended starting to ease a bit. Consumers have learned how to gain control over their finances, how to have some spending discipline. They're reporting that they're feeling more financially secure, though I do want to note that this is only 42% of Americans say, I'm financially comfortable. That's back about up to pre-recession rates, but there's still a lot of room for improvement there. And we've also seen financial anxiety ease posted here in keeping up with the cost of living, but in a lot of other areas in consumers' spending as well. And as consumers are starting to feel better about their today and where they are sitting, they're able to start thinking about tomorrow. And we see that they're starting to hope and dream again. Hopefully they're doing this with a beer in hand. But there's more energy that is in the marketplace pushing forward. Now, this energy doesn't necessarily mean that it's translating 100% to spending. And I want to show you a framework that we've used to look at consumers. We asked ourselves each year when we get our data back, our Yankelevich Monitor survey data, we make a few hypotheses and ask ourselves some questions. And one of our questions this year was, how able to spend are consumers really these days? And we found some encouraging news. Almost 60% of consumers are actually able to spend. So we asked ourselves a second question. We asked, how willing are they to spend? And that's where we found some not-so-pretty news. About two-thirds of that able-to-spend group is actually not willing to spend. So what's happening here? They're bored. They need some encouragement. They need enticement. They need a new experience every time they walk through your doors, or new taste sensations that get them experimenting and trying new things. They want something that livens up their lives, and they're not going to spend if they don't have that going on. So I want to shift now to our second theme, which is the blending of personal identity. Now, identity and individualism is something that is core to the American experience. It's all about who we are. But in the past decade, we've seen the need for individualism raise. It's been on the up and up. And this is not something that is driven just by millennials who've always known that they can personalize everything that they interact with, having grown up as digital natives. But we're actually seeing that a major shift in Xers and baby boomers wanting to express themselves more and identify who they are on a very personal level. So what is this looking like? What is this evolving shift of the American identity? Well, we've shifted from the hip swag of Will Smith to his son, Jaden Smith, who is right now the spokesmodel for Louis Vuitton's women's line. We've gone from Bruce Jenner to Caitlyn Jenner, from Friends to the Orange is the New Black. What we're seeing is a lot of those standard demographic categories that we've depended on are falling apart. And so we need new ways of looking at how the population is segmented. Now, the easiest place to point to this identity fluidity that is happening are with gender and with culture. We have at the very extreme end our stars like Miley Cyrus saying she doesn't identify with either being a man or a woman. But on a day-to-day, a more relatable level, we're seeing that gender cues aren't confining how we behave. We're also seeing that we're taking cultural influences, adapting them, adopting them, making them our own, and incorporating cultures that aren't just ours into the way we live our lives. And beyond gender and ethnicity, there's also a lot of other areas that are getting transformed in terms of our identity. We see a higher percentage of people associating as religious nuns. That's N-O-N-E-S, not nuns. We see more people associating as independent politically. And we're actually seeing a big shift in people who saying, instead of saying, I'm American, saying, I'm a citizen of the world. I'm a global citizen. That's especially skewed more towards those millennials, again, who've always known digital interaction on the internet. And fluidity goes way beyond identity, too. It's not just about demographically who we are, but it's also about how we live our lives, our lifestyle. And so it's, the way we eat is changing. We'll see fewer people choosing to have those three square meals a day, which opens up doors to new opportunities of other eating and drinking occasions. How we dress is changing in terms of, you know, yoga pants and athletic wear is becoming the new casual wear, the new jeans, per se. And how we work is shifting a lot, too. Last year, we added 700,000 freelancers to the market. And so that 9-to-5 work life is being challenged. And so that is shifting the way people are scheduling the rest of their days as well. And an example of a company that's really tapping into this new fluidity of identity is Mini. And this is an ad that I'll show here in a second, and probably a lot of you have seen. It premiered at the Super Bowl this past year. But Mini has a lot of stereotypes associated with it, and they've done a great job at combating some of those while still kind of crafting their own unique identity as a brand. Let me show it.
This is a chick car. This is a gay car.
This is a short man's car.
This is a cute car.
Slow car.
This is a single young professional's car.
This car has no street cred.
This car ain't hip-hop.
Kidless.
Cute.
Small.
This car doesn't care what you call it.
So they really were able to own that identity of defying labels across a wide spectrum of consumers that could drive their car. So the last key theme that I want to go over before I hand the mic back to Mike is values-driven consumption. And this is good news because craft beer has been ahead of the value space for a long time because authenticity is such a core component of the craft beer experience. And what we're seeing is that craft beer drinkers were a bit leading edge in this space. This started to resonate with them, and now we're seeing it resonating with the total population. Consumers want transparency. They're looking for brands and companies that really have a lot of courage and stand up for a cause, and they're looking for advocacy of those causes that they have. It's all about flying your own flag and really owning that identity that is so critical to our culture today. And REI did a great job of this. Many of you might be familiar with this. On Black Friday, the biggest sales day of the year, they closed their doors. They said they stood by their values that they have of being outdoors and being together with family and friends and encourage people to go outside and do something else besides shop. Really powerful message to their shoppers. Now, there are a lot of other ways beyond just connecting to your personal identity that you can connect with the values of consumers out there. And one way is through community interaction. We see more and more that consumers are really looking for companies that are doing something, taking part in their community. The poster child of this is New Belgium Brewing. As a certified B corporation, they're very involved in their local community, and the Tour de Fat is really gathers a lot of unique, eclectic people together among a shared passion. But community doesn't need to mean just local. Tom's Shoes is one that has done a great job at bringing community in a very different way than just emphasizing on the local community of their shops. They have a one-for-one policy, so when you buy one pair of shoes, they promise to give one pair of shoes to a child in need in an impoverished country. And what they've been doing is inside their stores, they've introduced a virtual giving experience. And this virtual giving experience is a virtual reality mask that you put on, and you go through what it's like when their employees go and distribute the shoes in a different country. And so you feel like you're part of that community, even though you're not physically there. So it's finding those links to make it feel more communal, like you're part of something bigger than yourself. Another key area to watch in terms of values is sustainability and giving back to the environment. And it's important for a business to be sustainable and leading edge in that, but it's also important to think about how can you make the person help live a more sustainable life too. How can you get them to feel like they're actually physically doing something that's giving back? That's what we see consumers wanting a lot today. And a unique way that we've seen this done is in Florida. There's a lot of different invasive plants and animal species that are ruining the natural habitat there. And a group of chefs has started something called Eat the Invaders, in which they'll cook up python and sow thistle and these different plants and animals that are invasive into amazing cuisines. And so when you dine out and enjoy one of these, or if you you buy it and cook it at home, you feel like you're actually doing something that is helping a cause that's very tied to your community. And as we think about all of these different values, it's really critical to know that this is going to continue to push forward. And a great example of how that's going to push forward is an app called Glia. And Glia lets you, when you sign up for it, insert different values that you have. They could be political, or they could be your stance on sustainability, or anything. There's a million different values that you can associate yourself with. And then they match that to businesses that are located around you. And so you can actually see that spectrum of blue to red, which ones match and align very well with my values and which ones are cautionary, they go against your values, and those are businesses you avoid. So there really is the risk that soon consumers will be consuming and being guided in a way that only matches their values and will be blocking out or not even seeing options that don't align with their values. And so with that, we want to dive in a bit more to women in craft beer. And I'm going to turn the mic back over to Mike.
Thank you. Okay. Basically, slicing and dicing this data a number of different ways, it becomes apparent, at least using the Yankelovich data, that craft beer isn't the problem when it comes to getting women to drink more. Beer is the problem. No surprise to many of you in this room, I'm sure. But we see, percent of adults who drink beer weekly, it's a little over a third of men, only 12% of women. Percent of beer drinkers who drink craft beer weekly, it's about the same for men and women. So basically it's saying once you get a woman to drink beer, she's just as likely to drink craft beer as a man is. So that's the hurdle to overcome right there. And so, in fact, my argument would be if you want more women to drink craft beer, you probably shouldn't be speaking to current beer drinkers as much as trying to get women to come into beer directly through craft beer. But the other point to be made here is that those women are probably more than likely wine drinkers, and we're actually going to compare women who drink craft beer to women who drink wine. And I do not want to say that wine is the enemy or anything like that. It's not about, converting women from wine to beer, but it's just seeing an opportunity among women who drink wine. Because if you look at this, women who drink beer once a week are more likely to be wine drinkers than to be craft beer drinkers, which was shocking to me. I mean, really, you'd think that if they're already drinking beer, they'd be more likely to drink craft beer, but they're in fact more likely to drink wine. So that's the group that I think is the opportunity. So what we're going to do is compare those attitudes and values of women who drink craft beer weekly with women who drink wine weekly. Now, where you see differing attitudes and values, those might be potential barriers. If a woman who drinks wine doesn't share an attitude that's common among craft beer drinkers, that might be one of the barriers keeping her from drinking more craft beer. But if they have similar attitudes and values, that might present an opportunity. That's saying, look, craft beer already has these values that you share. We just need to get the message out, convince more women that this is something we already share with you. So Big question. Is there evidence that current and potential drinkers among women don't see craft beer as inviting to women? There's a lot of anecdotal stuff on this. I think a lot of women will say, duh. But is there any data that supports this? Well, we don't have a smoking gun, but we do have some indirect evidence of this, so we'll look at some of that. Comparing women who drink craft beer and wine, the idea that you're someone who has a strong sense of self-esteem. 81% of women who drink craft beer weekly say, yeah, that's important to me. Only 73% of weekly wine drinkers. So does it take a little more confidence for a woman to make that jump into craft beer? Maybe. But we ask them questions like, agree or disagree. I'm frustrated by brands that treat me as an afterthought. Or I don't feel held back by social expectations about what is or is not appropriate to someone of my sex and gender. Even these more confident women, supposedly more confident women, are far more likely to say, yeah, I am frustrated by being treated like an afterthought. Those are women who are exposed to craft beer. Women who are weekly wine drinkers who aren't seeing much craft beer don't feel that frustration. So I think there's some indirect evidence there. And they're actually, those craft beer drinkers are actually less likely to say, I don't feel held back by social expectations. You ask them about the way women are portrayed in advertising, and both groups are pretty much in agreement here that women are not generally portrayed realistically in advertising. No surprise on that. I would point out that they are almost as likely to agree that men aren't realistically portrayed in advertising, so not sure what all that means, but it's an important thing to keep in mind. And though we talk about advertising and we usually think of TV advertising, I think we can apply this to marketing in general. It doesn't have to just be television advertising. Now, is there a perception of inappropriate marketing? We asked we asked everyone in the survey, but we said, agree or disagree, I'm often entertained by marketing and advertising that others might find inappropriate. 60% of women who drink craft beer said, yeah, I'm often entertained by that. Women who drink wine, not so much. So to the extent that there is, quote-unquote, inappropriate marketing in craft beer, I think we have some evidence here that that might be a barrier. And the other thing I should stress to keep in mind is that when you're talking to someone from outside your category, people who aren't currently using the category, it only takes one or two bad experiences or bits of evidence for them to think of the whole category that way. If you have no exposure to craft beer, you see something that you find inappropriate or offensive, you're going to think of all craft beer in that way. So that's something important to keep in mind. But are there more significant barriers? We've really kind of focused here on stuff that relates more overtly to gender. I think there are other barriers that have nothing to do with overt references to gender. For example, I think we would all agree, by and large, that the craft beer community and the craft beer culture really is all about community and acceptance. It's very egalitarian, very welcoming. But I would tell you that I've seen a lot of evidence it doesn't always look that way to people on the outside. So, for example, this is from another study. This is not something Yankelovich covers, but one of my clients is World of Beer, the chain of craft taverns, and I worked on a survey with them last year, and we asked people to pick pairs of statements. Which one of these statements comes closer to your attitude? Even though I love craft beer, I have to admit there can be quite a bit of snobbery to it, or people who think craft beer is about snobbery just don't get it. These are all craft beer drinkers in the survey. A third of craft beer drinkers would tell you, yeah, there's some snobbery here. And I would say, if it looks that way to those of us on the inside, how does it look to outsiders? It's a question I have. And we know from other research, any association with snobbery is going to be far more alienating to women than men. This is from another study. A woman named Marty Barletta, who's often considered America's foremost expert on marketing to women, she's done research on the attitudes and values in men and women, where men tend to, and these are general tendencies, it doesn't apply to everyone, of course, men tend to be hierarchical, they embrace ideas like superiority and exclusivity and uniqueness. Women tend to be more egalitarian, embrace equality, inclusivity, and commonalities. So, you know, if a man is not a craft beer drinker but interested in the category, if he sees some snobbery, he might not have as big a problem with that as a woman who's a potential drinker. And I will say men and women, and particularly men, are evolving on this. As Lindsay pointed out, this blurring of identities. Men are coming along. They're evolving, but there's still these tendencies that are out there. So, and the monitor data tends to agree with this. One of the questions is, agree or disagree, I like to buy brands that show others I'm successful. 37% of adult men agree with this, only 25% of women. So women are far less interested in projecting any kind of success. And yet if you look at women who drink craft beer and compare them to the wine drinkers again, women who drink craft beer are far more likely to tell you that the brands you buy tell a lot about the kind of person you are, and they are more likely, in fact, to like to buy brands that show others I'm successful. So I guess the point would be there are some status-conscious women out there, and craft beer already seems to have a lot of them. To get those other women who aren't yet drinking craft beer, you might have to, if there's any sense of snobbery, we've got to pull back on that a little bit. Other differences, women who drink craft beer are much more likely to embrace the idea of I'm someone who likes to take chances in life, 70% versus only about half of wine drinkers. I'm happy to take some risks for the chance to enjoy greater rewards. Again, a big difference there. Now, anytime you're trying something new, something different, there's risk involved there. And wine drinkers are more risk-averse than craft beer drinkers. They're also less likely to see themselves as unconventional, and they don't show the same level of pride in their BS detectors, as I like to put it. Weekly craft beer drinkers are much more likely to say, I'm someone who's willing to defy convention, and I'm someone who can always see through exaggeration and hype. I would argue that in the craft beer culture, there is I don't know if the word is a glorification, but the idea that I can see through exaggeration and hype, because, of course, we tend to say the big brewers have a lot of exaggeration and hype in their marketing. So I think that's something we value in the craft beer community, not valued nearly as much among women who drink wine. So basically what I'm saying is that, I don't want to skip ahead. What messages are going to resonate with the potential craft beer drinkers? These are going to be more of the attitudes and values that wine drinkers share with craft beer drinkers among women. Feeling connected to your community, very, very important among both groups. Companies that make sincere efforts to be a part of or invest in my community deserve my loyalty. Very strong agreement, both groups. So these are the kinds of messages that are already true, I think, of craft brewers. It's just a matter of getting these messages out to a wider audience if you want to attract more women. Sustainability, equally important to both groups. Interestingly enough, this idea of the independent and local angle, it's less compelling to potential drinkers. I look for goods produced in my state or nearby states. Many more women who drink craft beer agree with that than wine drinkers. And that's not surprising, I would think. That makes a lot of sense when you think about it. I like to buy things from smaller local companies. Again, a fairly sizable gap between the two groups. So my point is only that the independent local angle is hugely important for a lot of people. If you're actively seeking to attract women, it's probably not going to be as compelling to women who are out there drinking wine right now. This one shocked me. I don't know quite what to make of it, but we rely so much on social media in this category, and yet we ask people, I bought something due to a friend or connection posting about it on social media. I bought something due to a brand or business posting about it on social media. Huge gap. 70%, almost 70% of weekly craft drinkers agree with both. Less than half of weekly wine drinkers. I was very surprised to see that. But as far as the media we use, we might have to rethink reliance on social media if we want to attract more women. So just a quick summary of this. I do see some indirect evidence that women may feel excluded by the current craft culture. But there are bigger barriers that aren't overtly gender-related. I think that the whole, to the extent that people perceive it as snobbery, that's going to be more alienating to women than men, and that has nothing to do with an overt appeal to women at all. And then the question about social media doesn't seem to be used for brand decisions nearly as much. So now I'm going to talk about Hispanics and craft beer, do a similar type of analysis here. Excuse me one moment. Okay. We see a lot of evidence pointing to a cultural shift among Hispanics away from this idea of conforming to fit in to seeking individuality and growth. To a fair extent, this describes the transition that American culture has been making for the last 20 years and could be said to be enabling the growth of craft beer. But Hispanics are now more likely to agree with these sentiments than white non-Hispanic Americans. The idea of freeing yourself from the expectation of others is important to me. Striving to reach your full potential as a person, following your dreams. So Hispanic culture is really evolving as well. We see evidence of that in other ways too. Now, it's generally well known that Hispanics are more likely to choose imported beer than the general population. You can see that all adults, about 47% drink imported beer, 68% of Hispanics drink imported beer. But what's really interesting to me, craft drinkers choose imports fairly often, but import drinkers don't necessarily reciprocate. If you're a weekly craft drinker among Hispanics, almost half also drink imported beer on a weekly basis. But among weekly import drinkers, only a third drink craft beer on a weekly basis. So it's to me, the opportunity here is how do we get more import drinkers to drink craft beer? So again, we're going to do the same kind of analysis, look for similar attitudes and values and places where there are different attitudes and values, and we're going to compare Hispanics who drink craft beer with Hispanics who drink imports. As I said, we talked about Hispanics in general valuing this trend toward individualism and growth. We also see it prevalent among these two drinker groups, freeing yourself from expectations of others, striving to reach your full potential. Very, very important to both of these groups. But we've also got some interesting questions in the Yankelovich Monitor on Hispanics' relationship with their heritage, and we see some big differences here. I consider myself to be American first, Hispanic second. Half of Hispanics who drink craft beer weekly, almost half, agree with that. Only about a quarter of import drinkers. I often follow the customs and traditions of U.S. American people rather than the customs and traditions of Hispanics. Big gap there. And yet both groups say they speak Spanish very well. Import drinkers also feel less need to fit in by presenting themselves as more American. Have you ever felt the need to change your name or the pronunciation of your name in order to blend in? About a quarter of weekly craft drinkers, only about a sixth of weekly import drinkers. Also a big gap on, I'm often in situations where I feel I need to suppress how I express my Hispanic identity. So as a result of this, I think it's highly related. Import drinkers feel less need to think about how being Hispanic affects them. Weekly craft drinkers who do happen to be more in touch maybe with their American side say, I think a lot how being Hispanic affects me. Two-thirds of them say that, only about half of weekly import drinkers. But in terms of advertising and marketing, import drinkers actually have somewhat less of a desire to be addressed as Hispanics. I believe there should be more commercials and more products made specifically for Hispanics. 80 or 90% of craft drinkers agree with that, only about three-quarters of weekly import drinkers. So if you're trying to appeal to import drinkers, it's still a large number who say, yeah, it's important to address me as Hispanic, but not as important as it could be. And yet, when you ask the two groups how important it is to preserve various aspects of their culture, here the import drinkers give higher scores than the craft drinkers. Food, beverages, recipes, holidays, celebrations, rituals, music and songs, history. In each case, the import drinkers say it's more important than the craft drinkers to keep those traditions alive. So what do we see as the barriers to converting more Hispanic drinkers? Similar to what we saw with women, the non-craft drinkers are somewhat less open to risk, more risk-averse, less likely to see themselves as someone who takes chances in life or happy to take risks for the chance to enjoy greater rewards. And as I pointed out, the biggest barrier to trying something new is often the perception that there's risk involved. So you need to take out some of that risk, look for ways to do that. Again, similar to what we saw with women, the potential drinkers, the import drinkers, are less unconventional. Fairly close on saying it's important to be someone who can see through exaggeration and hype, not as big a gap as there was among women, but it's a somewhat small gap. And yet, here's, I think, a real critical key, and it's not a hurdle we can't overcome, but import drinkers are far less interested in new experiences per se. Importance of satisfying my hunger for new experiences. Three-quarters of craft drinkers say yes, only about 6 in 10 weekly import drinkers. But I think there's a way to address that. How else do the two groups compare? Again, community is extremely important to both groups. And companies that make efforts to be a part of my community deserve my loyalty. Similar among both groups. Again, this is a value that I think craft brewers and the craft community generally already share and embrace. It's a matter of getting the word out more, making it clear to potential new drinkers that these are things we value. Likewise, the environment is a pretty high priority among import drinkers as well. I was surprised at how high these numbers were, by the way. Weekly craft drinkers among Hispanics, 91% say, "I wish brands and businesses would make it easier for me to live an environmentally conscious lifestyle." I'm not surprised it was important. I'm surprised it was this widespread, and 88% of the import drinkers also agree. So again, sustainability efforts, worth sharing, worth getting the word out. And again, similar to what we saw among women, the local angle is less compelling for people who aren't currently drinking craft. It's a good message to have in general, good message to have for craft drinkers. Don't expect it to draw more people who aren't drinking craft right now. Again, both groups feel that brands say something about the people who drink them or use them, but the import drinkers are less likely to say they want to show others they're successful. Again, that status type consciousness, that potential snobbishness might be a barrier. I know we don't like to admit it might be there, but it can be seen that way from the outside. And again, import drinkers are far less likely to use social media for brand decisions. For all that we think that these attitudes and values are important, we've got to communicate variations on old messages to attract new drinkers. Sometimes it might be a matter of just we're in the wrong channels. So that's something we need to think about. So, a summary on Hispanics. This trend among Hispanic culture, it's evolving a lot. This embracing more individualism and growth has seemingly reached critical mass, is how I would put it. Current craft drinkers are much more in touch with their American side than potential new drinkers, but they do aspire to be more bicultural. Potential drinkers, more risk-averse, less interested in new experiences, and again, this question about social media. So, basically, we've covered a lot. How are we doing on time? Not too bad. A general summary and just some thought starters to take away with you before we go to questions. As Lindsay has talked about, energy's returned to the marketplace, but consumers are looking for a little more enticement to engage with brands. This idea of identity being flexible and fluid is really important. It's an ongoing thing. And as a result of that, values have become more critical means for consumers to connect with brands. Craft was ahead of this curve in many ways. We need to keep on pushing, I think, to stay ahead of this curve. As for women or Hispanics, I really believe, there's a lot bubbling up lately about overt targeting of Hispanics and women, and that's fine as far as it goes. But I think that it's more important to eliminate those barriers that have no overt connection to gender. The idea of making it more accessible, more friendly, even more welcoming than it already is. So I think we would all agree, at least I feel, craft beer has been becoming more and more mainstream in the sense that it's no longer considered this sort of thing off to the side. Craft has grown to the point where it really is becoming the new mainstream, so I think that's a good thing. I think that has helped us get more women and Hispanics, and it's probably, reinforcing that is the key to keeping that going. And that can help reduce the perceptions of risk or snobbishness that might be out there, I think. I also think, so Hispanics who don't drink craft beer aren't that interested in new experiences. I think there's potential here to look at this as the cure for flagship fatigue. Because even though someone might not be drinking Sierra Nevada Pale Ale or a Fat Tire or something like that, these are familiar brands. They've seen them out there. They know them. So rather than trying to come up with something new and exotic, maybe the key is to say, here's something that's fairly familiar and take advantage of that potential familiarity to overcome this resistance to new experiences we might be seeing. It seems obvious, but I'll say it out loud. Reinforce the image of craft as this warm, welcoming community of individuals. I think it's a good way to describe who we are. Not everybody's getting the message, though, so we need to do that. Continue promoting community and sustainability. And as far as the problem of seemingly not being on social media as much, both women and Hispanics who don't drink craft beer, maybe it's in-store marketing. Maybe invest more in getting marketing into the stores, into bars, promotions, signage, things like that. Worth investigating, I think, at the very least. So with that, it's time for a beer and questions. Thank you.
So great stuff, hung on every word. And I'm curious to know, and you might have covered this in the beginning, were they self-identified, wine drinkers, self-identified, craft beer drinkers? And how did...
Yes.
So self-identified.
Is this on? Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, self-identified by occasion.
Got it. And then what's your guys' take on this type of data where when you talk about craft based on overall beer lover, and then we compare craft to wine lover... There's different groups of wine lovers as well. So is there any way you can comment on if that would have skewed the data, or if you were actually having them self-identify a certain group of a high-end wine lover, which would be more, you know, apples to apples, or how do you address that?
So we had the data looks at how the frequency of drinking each beverage. So these were weekly drinkers.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
So that's where we kind of see it's a behavioral, self-reported behavioral measure of how often that you're consuming it. And so it's not just kind of love for it. There can be crossover of both drinking wine and beer if you drink that both in a week, normal week.
It's a good question. If we did have data on high-end wine drinkers, that would be a probably even more apt comparison. But I still think it's a valuable comparison.
Okay. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
I guess I have just more of an observation than a specific question, but I guess my question will be your response to my observation. One of the things that all of us know all too well is how promiscuous craft beer drinkers tend to be. And we tend to think in terms of winning people over to the category. And what I find to be a more useful way of looking at it is to just become part of the mix. So this idea of wine drinkers transitioning to craft beer, when I think about it, I think about I just want to be, you know, one part of their mix. So someone who self-identifies as a wine drinker, if I can get them to choose craft beer, preferably mine, say one out of every six times they go out and order, you know, some kind of alcoholic beverage, that's a big victory. And it seems like setting the bar pretty low, but I actually think when you multiply the numbers out, they translate into pretty significant numbers. So I guess in some ways, my observation is really, first of all, that how promiscuous craft beer drinkers tend to be, and I see that as partly the bane of our existence, those of us who are trying to build a brand, but also a significant opportunity because it allows us to draw people in to our category incrementally as we become part of that mix. But what's your thought about the promiscuous craft beer drinker, and where is that going to go? And I'll just say one more thing, and then I'll sit down, I promise. Personally, I think one of the worst things that's happened in craft beer, from my perspective as someone trying to grow a brand, is Untappd. You know, it encourages the one-and-done approach. And again, I've had people say to me, you know, I really love your beer. It's one of my favorite beers. But when I'm at a bar and I see something I've never tried before, I'll choose that, even though I know nothing about it. And then they check it off their list, and they're done, and they move on to the next thing. So I've loaded a bunch of stuff on you, but I'm kind of curious about, you know, your thoughts on those things.
Well, I share your perspective on the promiscuity of craft drinkers completely. And, it is really about getting people into the mix. I'm really not talking about, you know, flipping someone from wine to craft beer or anything like that. But it's just that an incremental drink every week that can really add up and make the difference. As far as Untappd, you're not the first person I've heard make that complaint. I guess I have nothing against Untappd, but I can see how that would happen exactly. Although I think, That's probably more of a problem when you're talking about really the hardcore craft drinkers. You know, in the context of today's presentation where we're talking about bringing in new people, I don't think that's an issue.
And I just build off that. Something we didn't get into it within the data today, but what we've been noticing is that core craft drinker tends to be an influencer. They're that more leading edge consumer that is trying to constantly try new things, and they're very connected on social media. And so I think that's a reason why we see them jumping around a bit, is because they want to be the first to know. They want to be the ones that share a new experience out to friends, either on social media platforms or in other means, just kind of face-to-face.
Hi. So I was curious to know, you chose to use women wine drinkers. Is there a study that's been done that is just overall spirit and wine craft alcohol consumers and getting them over to craft beer? Did I confuse
you? I didn't hear the last part of that, and getting them what? I'm sorry.
So you did you showed the study where women and wine, getting wine drinkers over to craft beer drinkers. I was curious to know if there was a study done that was the overall alcohol consumer, the wine alcohol consumer, versus it just being women, like women and men.
So we have data that looks at just women and men. We can kind of slice and dice it any way that we want. So we have looked at, you know, total women's attitudes and values versus those of wine drinkers, weekly wine drinkers, and those who drink beer or craft beer, more specifically, on a weekly basis.
But yeah, we have weekly spirits drinkers in the study too, and we could slice and dice this data almost any way.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. What are you seeing in terms of where consumers, women, Hispanics, but overall by demographics, are seeking information from companies? I mean, I saw the lower numbers on social media for people who skew different ways, but you know, on one hand, you have this pull of wanting to know things about companies before they buy, and on the other hand, it feels like you can have this pull of not necessarily wanting to engage with them on social media. So I'm just curious, what are some of the different media that these different segments are finding the most compelling to engage with?
Yeah, so I think this is not going to be the perfect answer, but then I'll kind of back up into it. What we're seeing, especially when I talked about identity fluidity and demographic parts of identity being less standardized and less ones that you can kind of wrap your head around and really connect with a consumer at those points, we're seeing that contextual ways of engaging with people is the best way to go. So that can be done in a lot of different formats. So it could be contextual. I'm standing at the bar ready to order a beer. So how can you message to me in that moment that's going to entice me to go with one over another? Or it could be contextual of like at planning an occasion, whether it's a planning to drink in or planning to go out and drink somewhere. Is it via my phone or is it via another means? So I wouldn't say that there's one platform necessarily or one means that is we really see trumping any others. It's more about, is the message coming to me when I need the message to come to me and when it's most relevant? Hope that helps.
Good afternoon. Is there any data that shows whether or not community involvement is something important as a past and present concept, and people are moving more towards an app like Glia? So as a business owner, if my values are different than yours, you're not going to come and buy a beer in my restaurant, or you may not pick my beer up off the shelf. So I may support adoption of puppies, and people may love that, but if they disagree with me on the car I drive, does that affect people coming in? Or are we moving more towards a consumer that looks at our values and what we do?
We absolutely are looking towards a future in which the consumer is more concerned about your values and knowing your values really align with your brand identity. That's the biggest thing. They don't want to see a mismatch there, and you can't have no identity. I kind of associate it of there's this shift from where consumers were trying to choose brands to put into their portfolio that helps contribute to their identity as aspirational. They're kind of like choosing an idol or a celebrity that you aspire to be. Versus today, it's more about kind of choosing a friend, choosing somebody that you want to kind of have in your crowd, your herd that you put around yourself. And so that's been a recent shift that we've seen. It's using brands and businesses that I interact with as a mirror to who I am personally. And so that doesn't mean that they need to be a perfect one-for-one match. If I dislike the car that you drive, that doesn't mean that I'm going to write you off, because I might have a prioritization of those values, and puppy adoption might be higher up on there. So that's one way that we're seeing. We're also seeing it of, you know what, I don't 100% align with this brand, but it doesn't go against my values, so I'm okay with that too. I'm proud. It's okay that their values are different, but I know who they are, and I'm making a conscious decision to still engage with them despite our differing values. So it doesn't mean that consumers are going to write you off completely and only zone in on values that align with theirs, but it is critical that they know what your values are so that they can make that choice, because if they don't see a personality with the brand, then it doesn't kind of exist in their world. It doesn't do anything to give them something in their identity portfolio.
So do businesses start to take a look? Do they base their value or their culture more on data going forward? Is that the future of a business, building their culture to understand what the greatest pool of consumer is?
On consumer data? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, so you base your culture around consumer data, saying, all right, this pool has the most consumers.
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I think that goes back to the need for authenticity within a brand. Consumers are really good at smelling out what doesn't feel right to them, what feels off. They're looking for to engage with brands that are really true to who they are and that really can deliver an experience that's unique, because by interacting with that brand, they might influence some of my values and how I see the world. So it's more about really having a strong core identity that you're projecting out, and then the values alignment kind of comes secondary to that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I have just a quick follow-up, actually, about the Glia app, or at least how consumers are looking for a bit more with the brands that they choose. Do you have numbers, or have you figured out like what percentage of consumers actually do want their values to match the company's values?
You know, I don't have an exact number off the top of my head, but we do see that it's like in the 70s and 80s percentile range of consumers saying that I'm looking for a brand that can really stand up for itself, that serves as an advocate for their consumers, and is core, like knows its core identity. So that's kind of the range of what we're talking about. Now, I don't think Glia's penetration rate right now is very high. It's a pretty new piece of software that's out there. So it's something that we see as like a really leading edge trend on the horizon.
Cool. And I just have one more quick question. You had mentioned that there's the flagship fatigue. Do you have any numbers on that, where I think most breweries here are probably going to be in agreement that our flagships are good. Why don't people buy more of those? They always want what's new. Have you asked that question in any of your surveys of what people want new, or do they drink the same beers week to week in craft beer?
The short answer is no. The Yankelovich Monitor, for all its strengths, really is not a beer survey. It's a survey of attitudes and values. But fortunately, there's a good fit between a lot of the questions and things we can use. But as far as like what they're actually drinking, in terms of brands or variety, that's not something the survey addresses.
All right. Thank you.
Hi. You may have covered this. I missed the first few minutes of the talk, but I was wondering, was this data collected kind of regionally in different parts of the country, or was it collected specifically to one region?
It's a nationally representative survey, and across demographics as well as ethnicity. And for Hispanics, we field it in language of choice.
Cool. Also, did you notice any variation in the data from different regions, you know, the Hispanics community in, let's say, L.A. versus Miami versus Chicago?
You know, we do see a lot of different regional fluctuations, but there's not huge stark differences, especially in what we were showing today. These are pretty consistent across the entire country. So with niche little attitudes, we see some shifts, but most kind of the bigger picture that we have presented today is consistent across regions.
And would it be possible to contact you guys to see if we can get some, if I can get some of that information?
Come up and talk to me after.
All right, perfect. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the data, by the way. One of the things that I was kind of interested in with kind of brand awareness, demographics awareness, and things like that, especially when you're marketing, you know. A lot of the brands in beer have like a bad boy approach to things. And so when you're bringing in like a new demographic, a new gender, how strong should you be with that marketing? You know, should it be overt, like our overt bad boy beer, or should we just tone that back so that we can kind of gain more followers in a sense?
If your brand positioning is about being a bad boy beer, then that's who you are and you need to be that. And I don't necessarily think that's a turnoff to women. I think it's how you present it. But, you know, my first credo is that you always have to be true to who your brand is and stay consistent. Now, to the extent that you can modify how you present it around the edges without changing that core, that's something to consider.
And it's not about pink washing, I would say. I think that's something that has been an easy way of saying we'll market to women. We'll come out with the girly beer. It's not about that. I think that it's about kind of being, striking up the authentic conversations with women, meeting them in spaces that they're having these conversations, contexts that they're choosing what to drink, and striking up the conversation there.
Yeah, we have some pretty target marketing in our brand. One of them is Dallas Blonde. The slogan for that is "Goes down easy." I mean, that's no compromise right there. And then we have another beer that's a Mexican style lager, Czech inspired, and we call it Nido Bandito. We just did a marketing campaign called Cinco de Nido. I think that's kind of working for us in our region. But I really would like to kind of know from your perspective how that might impact on a national level, you know?
I would say that you've got some potential alienation you might create with that if you're trying to go into new markets as far as women and Hispanics, yeah. Just a personal point of view.
All right. That's it for my questions. Thank you.
Excuse me, as the millennial group ages and starts having children, do you anticipate that their buying habits will change and they will become more brand loyal?
Yes, to some extent. So we've been doing a lot of research splitting the millennial demographic, so looking at those millennials who are 21 to 29 right now, and those who are millennials who are in their 30s. The oldest millennial right now is 37. In 3 years, they're going to be 40. That's a really big shift. In millennials, they're not kids anymore. Half of them have children. And what we see is that there are some big shifts that happen with millennials when they have kids, and there's just a bit of a split that's going on with the millennial generation in general. So a lot of the older generation, portion of the millennial generation experienced the recession at a slightly different point in their lives than the younger portion. And so they were a little bit more stabilized in their careers and their life path when that recession hit. So we see that a lot of their values are stronger, and brand loyalty is one of those values that we see resonate a lot more with older millennials than with the younger group. We don't perceive that changing with millennials as they age. It's really just kind of a factor of those millennials who are in their 30s were more stable when the recession hit, and so they were able to bounce back quicker, and they have a little bit less less negative feelings against bigger corporations and brands. So we see a higher brand loyalty in the older millennials. We also see some shifts that do occur, specifically when you start to have families and settle down more, and those tend to be more about being more health conscious because you're taking care of the entire family's health in the household, and being more tied to your culture as well. That's a big shift that we see because you want to pass down your heritage to your kids.
Thank you.
All right, at the beginning, you used REI as an example, sticking to their values, keeping closed on Black Friday. Do you have any numbers on, did their sales drop for that when they stuck to that value, or did, over the long run, did they go up because people thought, you know, they were sticking to the value, and I'm just wondering if the sales went up or down on something like that.
Yeah, I don't have the exact sales data with me, but we did see that their sales did just as well as they've always done in the holiday season.
Thanks a lot, you guys, for all the info today. One of the things that I really thought was interesting and identified with was the your BS detector statistic, because I think a lot of us could probably relate to that knee-jerk reaction when we see something. So I was wondering if you could maybe give some insight or speak to. A lot of times, I think when I see certain things that sense goes off, it's at the expense of the authenticity of the message. And what I'm understanding from what you're saying is that threshold is different for non-craft beer drinkers, right?
Right.
So do you have any, I guess, what would you say about trying to find that line? Because, you know, I tend to pull back from it because you want to remain authentic, but you're missing opportunities there, right? So what would you have to say about that challenge of finding where that line is or pushing it a little bit?
Well, I don't think being authentic and true to your values can ever hurt you, so I don't know that I'd agree that there's a line there. As far as the difference is that the non-craft drinker said they don't really take pride in being able to see through BS, but I don't think that necessarily relates to the value they place on authenticity.
So I guess I'm thinking of it in terms of putting your message out there in a way that, I don't know, The repeatability of it and the driving that message home. I think sometimes it feels like you've done that, you've said that already. You need to just show your values, I guess, as opposed to driving it and driving it and driving it.
Yeah, well, I'm a big believer in show, don't tell.
Right.
So it's really about your actions, your attitudes, things like that, more so than putting that message out there necessarily in words.
Sure. Okay, so it's just about finding those actions as
right.
opposed to
right.
the verbiage itself.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Right. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
And we're up here if you want to chat anymore.